Marty Moscowen, welcome to Radio Times. 4 years ago, the U.S. economy was in free fall while the world watched in horror. The housing bubble had burst, revealing serious and systemic problems on Wall Street. The stock market was collapsing. The country was in recession, hemorrhaging hundreds of thousands of jobs. Today, the economy is slowly recovering and Wall Street has rebounded. The recession is officially over, even as unemployment has remained stubbornly high. There are some bright spots in the housing industry, even though we haven't seen the end of the foreclosure crisis. Our guest, Michael Grunewald, says that President Obama and the $787 billion Recovery Act deserve a lot of credit for saving the country from a second depression. That's what he writes in his new book, The New New Deal, The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era. Michael Grunewald is an award-winning author, senior correspondent for Time magazine, and joins us from Florida, where he lives. And Mike Grunewald, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. Why hasn't the president and his administration done a better job selling the stimulus? Because I have to say, reading your book, you seem more enthusiastic about it than from what I hear from the White House.
Well, you know, there are a few reasons, and one of them you sort of alluded to. You know, we did have this financial earthquake, but the economic tsunami hadn't really hit the shore when Obama took office. You know, I do quote Larry Summers in the book during the in the December of 2008, saying, you know, FDR was lucky. He had there were 3 years of depression under Hoover before he took over. Everybody knew it was Hoover's depression. While with Obama, you know, the GDP had crashed 9% in the fourth quarter of 2008, which really is depression territory. When they passed the stimulus when he took over, and the next quarter you had the biggest improvement in jobs in 30 years, but it improved from absolutely terrifyingly hideous to just bad. And that's hard to sell. And just the whole idea of Keynesian economics is hard to sell after this, you know, you have this crisis created by banks gambling with money they didn't have and homeowners taking out loans they couldn't afford. Then you had this horribly unpopular bank bailout, and suddenly Obama comes in and the solution is to, you know, spend $800 billion of borrowed money at a time when families and businesses are tightening their belts. It was a tough sell, and it wasn't helped by this incredible Republican campaign of distortion, Democratic messaging problems, and the media not really interested in telling the real story.
Well, let me take apart some of the stimulus, and I think a lot of people would be surprised. About 95% of the public actually got a tax cut. Now, that tax cut was in their paychecks. It wasn't a check that was sent in the mail. I know that was done for economic reasons, but do you think there were strategic reasons for why that might not have been as effective as it could have been?
Oh, yeah. I think Obama supporters who read that section of the book, their heads are going to explode. You know, Rahm Emanuel was running around at the time saying, hey, we're denying ourselves an Ed McMahon moment, right? That squeal of publisher's clearinghouse pleasure when you get your check in the mail from Barack Obama. But instead, they did dribble it out a few dollars a week through your paycheck so that nobody noticed it. Because behavioral science shows that when you don't notice it, you're more likely to spend it, and that when you get the big windfall in the mail, you're more likely to save it, which doesn't stimulate the economy. But when you don't notice it, you don't notice it. And so I do quote Ron Klain, who used to work for the vice president, sort of saying that their idea was that if you do the policy right and you get results, that the politics will sort of take care of itself. But less than 10% of Americans realized they got this tax cut. And Ron did say that, in retrospect, it was just stupid.
But do you think it was also naive on their part?
Yes. There was this wind blowing from the top from Obama that said, hey, we're just going to focus on the policy. This is a crisis. This is an emergency. We're going to do the right thing, and we're not going to worry about the politics. And they did think that would ultimately be good politics. They were just really wrong about that.
Another sort of broad part of the stimulus bill were, besides the tax cuts, money that was sent to the states, and also a variety of investment in various programs, including infrastructure. But what we learned is that being or talking about something being shovel ready doesn't necessarily mean that things are shovel ready.
Well, look, this bill was actually, I mean, everybody knows it as the stimulus, but it was called the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. And so the main part of it was basically trying to jumpstart a short-term recovery. And that's, you know, a couple $100 billion worth of aid to states to prevent them from laying off hundreds of thousands of teachers and cops and slashing tens of billions of dollars out of their Medicaid programs that provide health care for the poor and nursing homes. It was also those tax cuts that went out very quickly, aid to victims of the Great Recession that lifted 7 million people out of poverty, $250 checks to every senior citizen and disabled veteran. And that was just sort of standard Keynesian mm-hmm. stimulus, get the money out the door and try to create a recovery. Then there was also this long-term reinvestment part, which is really the purest distillation of what Obama meant by change. And that's why I called my book The New New Deal, because this really was sort of Obama's way of trying to transform the country and keep his campaign promises in his first month in office. You had $90 billion for clean energy when we'd been spending just a few billion dollars a year. You were, had really dragging our pen and paper healthcare system into the digital age. You had the largest infrastructure investment since Eisenhower. You had the largest education reform in decades with Race to the Top. You had the largest research investments in the history of the country. And those were really, they were not designed to be shovel ready. there was an understanding that in a serious recession like this, it was going to take a few years and you didn't need all of it to spend out in the first 6 months. But really it was trying to make, try to use the government to do things that were shovel-worthy, to try to transform some of those problems that Obama had talked about with education, health care, energy, and really the structure of the economy. And, things like high-speed rail and broadband, which was really a new version of the kind of New Deal's rural electrification, new ways of doing unemployment insurance. They really modernized the New Deal system, a new homelessness prevention program. These were really innovative, reform-minded experiments that were really what he meant by change.
But do you think there was too much of that stuff packed into this Recovery Act?
Well, no, I don't. I don't think there's any evidence. There's only so much pig you can shove through the federal python in 18 months. Which was the original target to try to get most of the spending done in the first 18 months, and they did. They hit every spending target. So when Obama said that shovel ready wasn't as shovel ready as we thought, he's really being disingenuous. Shovel ready was exactly as shovel ready as they thought. Again, they made every deadline. They were on time, under budget. It was remarkably fraud free. People had guessed before, the experts had said that you can expect to lose 5 to 7% of the stimulus to fraud. So far it's been 0.01%. This money has gone out the door. It hasn't had the kind of Grand Coulee Dam and Fort Knox and some of those kind of iconic projects that might have taken 5 or 10 years that some people wanted to see. But it has had the world's largest wind farm and a half dozen of the world's largest solar farms, and it's created an advanced battery industry for electric vehicles entirely from scratch. And they're building a new eco-friendly Coast Guard headquarters in Washington, D.C. So it's sort of a different kind of shovel-ready or shovel-worthy project. But in its own way, it's just as transformative.
I watched a small train station being built. It's a lovely little train station on my train line from the Recovery Act. But you talk about the Coulee Dam, and I wonder, perhaps with the advantage of hindsight, and we can look back at the New Deal and see some of these huge projects that were created under the New Deal, whether that helped to sort of promote the positive parts of the New Deal, because you could point to the Coulee Dam and say, we built that.
Sure. Well, right. Exactly. The Recovery Act had the largest dam removal project in the history of the country, in the Pacific Northwest on the Elwha River that's going to restore salmon flows there. But I take your point that it's not as iconic. And in fact, only 22 states actually even put up signs that said these projects are being funded by the Recovery Act, mostly states with Democratic governors. And so this didn't have the kind of PR. And that gets mm-hmm. back a little bit to your first question, where you had, it's tough to sell a jobs bill while jobs are hemorrhaging. And then at the same time, you had this incredible Republican campaign of distortion that I really write for the first time in this book, I document some of these secret meetings where the Republicans, before Obama even took office, were plotting their strategy of no. And they were very shrewd, and they made the same thing sound like $800 billion worth of levitating trains to Disneyland and mob museums and turtle tunnels and honeybee insurance and all kinds of nonsense that isn't even in the actual Recovery Act. Meanwhile, you had Democrats who, rather than defending it, were more, you know, they, oh, it's too small, or there are, you know, too many tax cuts, or it's not shovel-ready enough. And it all just sort of added to this cacophony, this drumbeat of it's a mess, which the media, the national media, isn't really that interested in public policy and isn't really interested in adjudicating the truth when you have, you know, they do he said, she said stories, and when he says it's a mess and she says it's a mess for different reasons, there wasn't a lot of incentive for reporters to go to figure out what was really going on.
And I want to pick up on that, but let me go back to what you write in your book. And Mitch McConnell has famously said his goal, or the goal of Republicans, is to make President Obama a one-term president. You write about Eric Cantor, House Whip, and the kinds of negotiations and dealings he was doing behind the scenes. What was going on there?
Well, really, what they recognized, and this is after the election, and you got to remember, it really did, as President Clinton would say, it took some brass, because, you know, the president-elect Obama was at 70% in the polls, right? There had just been 2 million people yes we canning on the National Mall. Everybody was saying that the Republicans were on the road to extinction. Are they the Whigs? Are they the Federalists? And surely they're going to have to cooperate with the president during an economic emergency at this historic time. And, you know, sort of Eric Cantor had this diabolically clever notion that their way back to power was no, that there was no point in just saying me too. It was just going to alienate the few voters who hadn't abandoned them. And that, look, in 2 years, there was going to be another election, and if Obama hadn't magically fixed things, that was going to be the Republicans' ticket back to power, as long as they could stay united and deny him these bipartisan victories. Because most of us, you know, I'm paid to follow this stuff, but most people don't pay attention to everything that happens in Washington, the details of legislation. They just hear either, hey, Washington has a bipartisan plan, reasonable people have kind of gotten together and figured out what to do, or else there's partisan bickering, it's the same old Washington, nothing ever changes. And especially after Obama had made all those promises about post-partisanship and changing Washington, the Republicans realized that they could turn him into a promise breaker just by saying no.
Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Michael Gruenwald about his new book, and it's called The New New Deal, The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era. And he is a national correspondent for Time magazine, an award-winning journalist, joins us from Florida where he lives. We'll talk more after this very short break. Also, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
A stroke can rob us of our ability to speak, to move, to understand. The new Mainline Health Neurovascular Center at Bryn Mawr Hospital uses an interventional approach to the rapid treatment of stroke and aneurysm. Formed in collaboration with stroke experts from Jefferson's Faculty Practice Plan and the Jefferson Neuroscience Network, they use minimally invasive techniques to avoid open brain surgery, to prevent disabilities, and to save lives. The Mainline Health Neurovascular Center at Bryn Mawr Hospital supports WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, we're joined by an extraordinarily cute 11-week-old puppy who is about to be trained to do extraordinary work as a search and rescue dog. We talk with the founder of the University of Pennsylvania's new Working Dog Center, Dr. Cynthia Otto. She worked with dogs at Ground Zero. And we'll meet the center's training director, Anne-Marie D'Angelo. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Greener Partners, announcing their annual Square Dance and Pig Roast, Friday, September 28th. And they're celebrating the Harvest Festival, Saturday, September 29th. The festival features family activities such as local food vendors, heritage breed animals, hay rides, an heirloom tomato contest, and more. Both events will be held at Hillside Farms in Media, PA. For tickets to the Square Dance and Pig Roast on Friday evening and for more information about the festival on Saturday, greenerpartners.org/heirloom.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Michael Grunewald. He's an award-winning journalist, senior national correspondent for Time Magazine, author of a new book called The New New Deal, The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Administration. And he says, in spite of what critics have said, the 2009 stimulus worked. In fact, saved the country from a second depression. And the stimulus has had its critics on both the left and the right. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Michael, going back to 2009, the Republicans also had a stimulus bill. What was their, how different was their bill from the one that got passed?
Well, they had a few, but the one that I've been banging my spoon on my high chair about there was a $715 billion Republican substitute in the House that was really almost identical to the Obama stimulus. It had a little bit less stuff for green energy, less wind and solar and energy efficiency. It had less for youth summer jobs in the inner city that Republicans don't like. It didn't have as much for AmeriCorps. It certainly cut out the artists. It had a little bit more pork for the Army Corps of Engineers. But it was $715 billion of tax cuts and spending, which was, and even Paul Ryan voted for that while continuing to denounce Obama's $787 billion of tax cuts and spending as Sharia socialism and the death of American free enterprise. But I think it does, what it really underscores is this notion that the Republican sort of campaign against this new socialist enterprise in the White House really was, it was purely cynical, and it was purely circumstantial. I mean, every presidential candidate in 2008 had a stimulus plan, and Mitt Romney's was the largest. And of course, as people have heard, after the stimulus passed, 128, I call them cash and trash Republicans, did send letters asking for stimulus money to the Obama administration or show up at ribbon cuttings or send out press releases taking credit for stimulus projects. So this was not a deeply principled opposition to big government and big spending. It was they saw an opportunity to make Obama look like, you know, big government liberal.
But as you say, this PR campaign that was mounted by the Republicans seemed to have been effective, because there was a not for everybody, obviously, but a general feeling or perhaps misunderstanding about the stimulus.
Sure. I mean, a year after the stimulus passed, the percentage of Americans who believed that it had created any jobs was lower than the percentage of Americans who believe Elvis is alive. Mm-hmm. So this has been a messaging disaster. And I do tell the story in the book about some of the internal fights where, for instance, Rahm Emanuel was very insistent that Obama needed to just be talking about jobs, 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 while others like Joe Biden, for example, said that numbering jobs was kind of a losing battle because we were going to continue losing jobs no matter how big the stimulus was, and that it made more sense to sort of talk about what I've called the New New Deal aspect of it. Obama did make a speech in April 2009 where he talked about the new foundation, referring to the proverb where, you know, instead of building the house on sand, we were going to try to build on the rock of clean energy and, lower health care costs and education reform and, you know, a sort of a fairer tax system where you have these middle-class tax cuts and you have infrastructure that can really serve as a base for economic competitiveness. But then, you know, Doris Kearns Goodwin said that the new foundation sounded like a girdle. And, they used it in like 15 speeches, and then they kind of dropped it. I quoted with the communications director at the time saying that she had thought about setting up a whole website devoted to the new foundation and branding it, and that should have been the message of the first 2 years. But, you know, the auto bailout happened, healthcare happened, and the message just kind of got away from them.
You also describe, and perhaps this is very typical for the kind of wheeling and dealing that goes on in Congress, not only Rahm Emanuel, and I guess he really does use the F-bomb as much as everybody says, but he's yelling and screaming at everybody. Harry Reid seems to go so far as to say that if you don't pass this, you're going to kill Senator Kennedy.
Yeah, it was kind of crazy in there, and I do hope people will read the, do this kind of fly in the wall stuff of how this thing actually became law. Right. And certainly Rahm screaming and cursing, and he's kind of not safe to work, and he is this kind of frenetic, volcanic figure in the middle of this. It is true that Harry Reid told he pulled three Republicans into his office and sort of begged them to vote for the stimulus, and when they said no, he threatened that they would have to roll Ted Kennedy off his deathbed and onto the floor, and it would probably kill them. And they kind of looked at each other and said, "Huh?" But it was a very ugly time. And the one thing I hope people in particular take from this is that really does set the stage for the way the tyranny of getting 60 votes in the Senate. It really has driven the arc of the Obama narrative in ways that people don't entirely understand, particularly on the left. You hear this whining, oh, why wasn't the stimulus bigger? And it's true that a bigger stimulus could have, saved more teachers' jobs, more tax cuts, which is what a bigger stimulus essentially would have been. It would have provided more money to people's pockets. More public works would have put more unemployed laborers on the job. But the fact is you had three Republicans in the Senate who were not going to vote for this thing if it had one dime more than $800 billion. And what's never been reported is that you also have a half dozen Democrats who are saying the same thing. I quote, President Mark Begich saying from Alaska, this new guy who comes to Washington and decides that $800 billion is going to be his absolute limit. And unless you're going to impeach him, that's what you're up against. And I think Obama recognized very early on, despite all that flowery change the system rhetoric, that he really had to work the system as an insider, and that bills that don't pass Congress don't make change. And I think you saw the same thing happen in health care, where a lot of people said, oh, why no public option? Because he didn't have the votes for the public option. And why is he reaching out to Republicans? Because there are a half dozen centrist Democrats who, if he doesn't reach out to Republicans, they're going to bail on him. So that really has sort of constrained his one way of looking at it is that, it's been this kind of squinched presidency where he's barely had to thread this needle. Another way is like, wow. This guy's gotten some very big things done considering the needle he had to thread.
I'm wondering, even looking at how this piece of legislation became law, comparing that to other big bills of the past. And in the past, I'm thinking of Johnson and others. I mean, they used earmarks. They twisted people's arms. I'm sure they used what Rahm Emanuel uses, yelling and screaming at people. But do you think the fact that earmarks are not used the way they have been in the past, or even, various projects that you give to somebody in order to get them to vote for your bill, do you think that has tied people's hands and particularly the White House's hands?
Well, maybe a little. The first thing I would point out is that, even though this bill has been known as porculous on the right, it was actually the first modern spending bill with no earmarks, which is the general definition of pork, is sort of when legislators stick their pet projects into a bill. That said, there was a little bit of that. Daniel Inouye got his $150 million for Filipino veterans of World War II. And, I feel terrible for those guys who were on the Bataan Death March, but it was kind of hard to see how sending money to these 90-year-olds in Manila was going to provide stimulus in Milwaukee. There were catfish subsidies for Blanche Lincoln, and there was a clean coal project for Dick Durbin. So there was a little bit of that. But it is true, the best example I have in the book that's, it's kind of funny, Joe Lieberman was watching Arlen Specter insist on $10 billion for the National Institute of Health. And Lieberman called it the most noble shakedown he'd ever seen. Rahm Emanuel was screaming and cursing and saying, how the bleep am I going to keep this thing below 800 bleeping dollars if I have to give every bleeping senator their own 10 bleeping billion dollars? But the fact is, you had to get it done. And I suppose that not having earmarks may have made it a little more difficult, but ultimately this is always the problem in representative democracy, right, is that to round up your votes, you need to give people something that they want to vote for. Ultimately he got his 60 with nothing to spare, and the same thing happened in healthcare.
Was Rahm Emanuel effective in that role?
You know, he really was. And this is Rahm. I think if you really don't like Rahm, you'll find some stuff in this book to really, you know, get angry about. You know, some examples would be his obsessive focus on, you know, oh, it's going to be 3 million jobs. That sort of horrible White House economic report that predicted that the unemployment rate would remain under 8%, that politically disastrous thing that they should never have put on paper, that really came from Rahm's insistence that we need jobs numbers to sell this on Capitol Hill. The idea that when the stimulus finally passed, Obama, instead of saying this is just the start and we may need more stimulus down the road, instead that he was so triumphant about it, that really was a Rahm push. He believes that winning begets winning, and you've got to always act like you're winning, and you can never show any weakness. You've got to celebrate like you've just won the World Series every time. That said, you know, it was his job to do the dirty work, and as he said to me, you know, I asked him about Obama, sort of whether this tarnished his reputation and made it look like Obama was sort of getting down into the muck, and Rahm said, "Oh, no way! It was his chief of staff who was pure, you know, who was the whore. The president
talking about himself,
was pure,
right?
As the driven snow." So I think Rahm, you know, he had a role to play, and Obama picked him for a reason. He understood that when he got to Washington, it was an economic emergency, and whatever he had said about changing the game in Washington, the first thing he needed to do was win it, so that he could change the country. And some people will always be upset about that, and you know, will say, "What if he had appealed to people's better angels or something like that?" But you know, it was a really tough time, and it was a scary time, and they felt like they needed stimulus fast, and they got it done in less than a month.
And that's Michael Gruenwald joining us today on Radio Times as we talk about his new book called The New New Deal, The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era. And it's his investigation into the 2009 stimulus bill passed shortly after Obama became president. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me ask you about Solyndra, something that you write about in your book, and many people have written about as well. This was a solar company, basically failed as a company. Help us understand what happened and the role of the Obama administration.
Sure. I think, you know, I'm always saying that just about everything people think they know about the stimulus is wrong. Well, just about everything people think they know about Solyndra is wrong, too. You know, Solyndra was not some fly-by-night, you know, company in somebody's garage. It was the toast of Silicon Valley. They had raised $1 billion in private capital, not just from Democratic hacks. The Walton family, which are Republican donors, they were investors in Solyndra. Richard Branson, the British mogul, had picked Solyndra from among 117 solar firms. And then, in fact, the Bush administration, which had started, you know, President Bush signed a bill in 2005 that created this clean energy loan program. It was very bipartisan at the time. Now, of course, it's become socialist, green, airy-fairy, picking winners and losers. But this was a very popular program, and the Bush administration chose Solyndra from among 143 applicants to receive the first loan. It didn't quite get done before he left office in January, but the Obama people picked up the ball, and they were very eager to move things forward, and the Solyndra loan was the only one that was almost done. They had this very exciting technology. It was really, they called themselves the new shape of solar, and it really was. It didn't look like a normal solar panel. It looked like a lizard ladder. And it didn't use silicon, which was incredibly expensive, and that's one of the reasons solar was having so much trouble competing. This was using a different substance, and the idea was it would take advantage. They were making expensive solar panels, but their idea was that once they got to scale, once they were creating, had big customers, that they would be able to reduce their costs. And they did have, after they got this $535 million loan, they built a factory on time and on budget, and they were churning this stuff out. And their sales went from $6 million to $200 million. They had customers like Frito-Lay and Walmart and Southern California Edison, and then silicon got cheap. So solar got cheap. And their entire business model just fell apart. And so what ended up happening was Solyndra went under, and that was a $535 million default. And it was very embarrassing. But this idea that, you know, people have said that it shows that solar is just a mirage. In fact, solar installations have increased 600% under the stimulus. And while Solyndra failed, other companies like Solar City, for example, which installs solar panels, is going public. Overall, you know, it's unfortunate that Solyndra failed, but that clean energy loan portfolio has lent out $40 billion, and it's doing fine. John McCain's finance chairman led a review of the portfolio and found that there's really no risk that they're going to have more defaults than they have money budgeted for. And this is what happened. The idea is that some of these projects are going to fail. That's part of what happens when you invest in these industries of the future. But the idea is that some of the other ones will change the game. And that program is also supporting, you know, the world's largest solar farm and half dozen of the world's largest solar farm and the world's largest wind farm and America's first cellulosic ethanol refineries. It's doing all kinds of exciting things. You know, we have a new advanced battery industry for electric vehicles in this country before we had to import all that stuff. You know, we've doubled our domestic manufacturing of U.S. wind turbines, so that now we're making a lot more of that stuff in the U.S. We've had record investments in wind and solar and energy efficiency and the smart grid and advanced biofuels and cleaner coal. These are all efforts to kind of change the game in clean energy. Some of them are working out really well. We've doubled our renewables, and some of them are going to fail.
You write in your book, and I underlined it here, the rap on Obama in 2008 was that he was a words guy, not a deeds guy, a great communicator, but not an accomplished legislator. It turned out that he was more of a deeds guy. And I ask that because you just went through a long list of programs and renewable technologies and wind farms and solar farms, advanced batteries, that frankly, and I know I said this before, frankly, we don't hear about coming out from the Obama administration. About a minute before a second break here.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I had a piece in the Washington Post about the five myths of the stimulus, and I heard the president read it, and he was kind of joking with his staff. He's like, oh, you know, I'm going to put this into my stump speech. I'm going to start bragging about the stimulus. And the political aides were like, no, anything but that.
Why did they say that?
They've definitely decided that cake is baked, that the stimulus just became so unpopular. You do hear him starting to brag about doubling renewable power, about the middle class tax cuts that were in the stimulus, about the Pell Grant expansion that were in the stimulus. But talking about the stimulus is just, I just went to the Democratic convention. You even hear them talking about Obamacare now, but I didn't hear the word stimulus once.
Because it's a dirty word?
Yeah. Obama said to his economics team in the fall of 2009, look, I get the Keynesian thing, but it's not where the electorate is. And they've just decided that politically there's no upside in trying to brag about that stuff.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Michael Grunewald. He's a senior national correspondent for Time Magazine, author of a new book called The New Deal. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Philadelphia Live Arts and Philly Fringe supports WHYY and presents its 16th annual Contemporary Arts Festival, now through September 22nd, featuring local and international theater, dance, music, and visual art events. Spotlight shows include Red Eye to Haverty Grace, an inventive work by Lucidity Suitcase Intercontinental that follows the mysterious last days of Edgar Allan Poe, and Food Court, an experimental piece from Australia's visionary back-to-back theater. Details and tickets at livearts.fringe.org.
Next time in Studio 360, have you ever noticed that pop songs these days are not so poppy?
I remember when we broke up the first time.
Why major hits are minor key. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
What?
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young from Public Radio's daytime news magazine, Here and Now. We bring you the news that happens between the morning headlines and the afternoon wrap-up, plus conversations with authors and music makers, stories that affect you, maybe a story about you. So please join us for Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, Here and Now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Michael Grunewald. He's senior national correspondent for Time Magazine. He blogs at Time's blog, Swampland, and we're talking about his new book, The New New Deal. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Mike, let me get some callers in, and then I still have some more questions for you, but we've got Eugene from Sicklerville, New Jersey. Eugene, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Good morning, Marty and Mr. Grunewald, if I'm pronouncing your name correctly.
Close enough. Go ahead.
Okay. Marty, the last time you and I talked, Bernie Mac was on your program.
Oh, my goodness.
Here I am again.
There you go. Well, go ahead, Eugene.
Good hearing from you. Listen, my question to Mr. Grunewald is that why hasn't, and I'm fascinated by your book. I'm going to pick it up today. Why hasn't more credit and support been given to President Obama publicly to negate the negatives that have been put out, you know, by talk show hosts and others that seem to highlight the negativities regarding him instead of his accomplishments, as you're talking about today? That's my question.
Fair enough,
Eugene. And I'm sure you have a good answer.
I'm sure
thank
he does,
you
too.
Much.
You're very welcome, Eugene. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. Michael Grunewald, go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate your interest in the book. I do think that there's a real nervousness in the White House about sort of appearing triumphant about its accomplishments at a time when so many Americans are hurting. And that said, as I do describe in the book, how really they felt right out of the box, particularly the debate over the stimulus, it just got away from them. I quote Dan Pfeiffer on the record. He was a communications director talking. he'll kill me for saying this, but he was really whining a little bit about how everybody was so tired. They just fought this 2-year campaign marathon, and then they had to run this 100-yard dash. And, you know, you don't know where the bathrooms are in the White House yet, and the economy is crashing, and people are telling you if the Recovery Act doesn't pass, you're going to, the market's going to fall another 3,000 points, and they just didn't have the time to have the kind of strategic thinking that you'd want. They always tell the story about how Obama finally did try to get hold of the message, and he summoned the 5 major network anchors to the White House to have this kind of fireside chat type thing, where he would finally get to tell the good side of the stimulus. And that morning, Tom Daschle, who was supposed to be the healthcare czar, withdrew his nomination because he hadn't paid all his taxes. And so all the questions were about how did you mess up the Tom Daschle nomination, and he never really got to get his message out. I think this is a long way of saying that they really have had trouble getting their story straight from the beginning, and by the time they finally felt like they had the message right and they passed a bill that had a big policy impact, then they had to go do the auto bailout and then health care while Republicans were still on their same political message, which is no big government, big spending. Now, the Republicans felt like the stimulus was a huge victory for them. They had this, the House Republicans had a retreat after their unanimous vote against the stimulus, where Obama had just passed this huge $800 billion bill that had half of his agenda embedded inside it, and they were celebrating. They played the tape. John Boehner played the tape of the vote, and everybody gave a standing ovation. Eric Cantor said, yeah, you know, we're going to have more votes like this. Mike Pence showed a clip from Patton, the movie, where the general's saying, we're going to run through the enemy like crap through a goose. And, of course, he was talking about the Nazis, but the implication was that's what the Republicans were going to do to Obama. It was just, sort of one side that was just totally focused on the politics and one side that was trying to govern.
Picking up on something you said earlier, and you're joining us from Florida, and it almost sounds like you live outside the Beltway for good, perhaps, journalistic reasons.
Yeah.
But do you think there is something that we can say about the inside the Beltway press, the kind of a punditocracy there and a kind of narrative that people sign on to?
Oh, absolutely, and I hope people will read the book because I do name some names and call out some of the ridiculous coverage. Look, I think the media blew the story of the stimulus as badly as it blew the run-up to the war in Iraq. And And it's true. I was at the Washington Post for 9 years. I have many good friends in Washington. But I now live in the public policy paradise of South Beach. And I have to say that if
you.
I still lived inside the Beltway, I do not think I could have written this book. The groupthink is just too strong, the kind of herd mentality where the conventional wisdom that this thing is just an $800 billion joke, if you even try to talk sincerely about the stimulus, it's like you just don't get it. You got to sort of sneer and roll your eyes about it. I just think, there was sort of no percentage for people who, they follow the narrative and the president is up or the president is down. And when the president is down because jobs are disappearing, everything he does is idiotic and all of his advisors are feckless. And it was not easy to sell this book in the fall of 2010, and it hasn't really been that it wasn't easy to write it in 2011, and now it's been it's going better
we'll
than
see.
I thought, but you know it's not easy trying to make this counterintuitive case that hey change happened when even Obama's supporters seem sort of resigned to the fact that you know change was just a lot of hot air.
But do people accuse you of shilling for Obama since you write in many ways glowingly about the stimulus bill?
Well, I do think it's sort of only glowing in comparison to these sort of gotcha stories without the gotcha that have been written for the last 4 years. The Republican National Committee did a 4-page memo just based on stuff from my book, and there was no rebuttal. It was just they just cherry-picked things that they thought made Obama look bad. And there is some really tough stuff, particularly there's a scene where Valerie Jarrett puts some inappropriate political pressure to try to get a loan passed to keep one of Obama's campaign promises. There's tough stuff. But look, you know, I realize that even though I've always been considered this, I hope, this sort of tough and fair reporter, even Vice President Biden was giving me a hard time. He's like, "Oh, I loved your stimulus stories. I took them to bed with me."
That's Biden, right?
Yeah, and I didn't get it. I didn't get into journalism to write the kind of stories that Joe Biden would want to cuddle with. I am sort of a contrarian, and I tend to zig when other people are zagging. And this just struck me as this gigantic story that was hidden in plain sight, where you had, we'd been spending a few billion dollars a year on clean energy, and suddenly we're spending 90. You know, we'd been spending a couple million dollars a year on health IT, and every Republicans and Democrats had said it's a huge scandal that your doctor can kill you with his chicken scratch handwriting. But suddenly we pour in $27 billion with a B. This was just obviously a huge deal, and I didn't know it was a good deal when I started reporting it. But ultimately the kind of bottom line was that he did what he said he was going to do. And people don't have to like what he said he was going to do, but this notion that somehow he hasn't kept his promises or he had this secret socialist plan, it makes my story sound boring, and I think it's a fascinating story that's really dramatic and gripping and funny, but ultimately the bottom line is that this guy who sort of presented himself as this left-of-center, pragmatic, no-drama technocrat turned out to be exactly that.
You write about the 2010 deal that was made in December, the lame duck session that was fashioned and towards the end of that year, basically as a second stimulus. There were payroll tax cuts and some other things that were agreed upon. We are now facing this fiscal cliff at the end of the year, and if Congress doesn't do something, tax cuts will expire. There's this sequestration, or I guess looking at cutting something like $1 trillion out of both defense and some kind of social programs. Do you think there's an appetite for some kind of agreed upon negotiations?
Well, I think the first thing to remember is that you know, it could have been worse as a lousy bumper sticker.
Yes.
But it really could have been worse. And you look at what's happened in Great Britain and in Spain, where they really have turned to the austerity that Republicans have called for in the U.S., and they've all lapsed back into double-dip recessions. While the U.S., where you have Obama, who's been pushing for his Jobs Act and essentially more stimulus, while the Republicans have just been saying no to that but pushing austerity, which Obama has blocked. So we've just had the status quo, and we still have this same kind of lame recovery, just kind of limping along. it is true that the fiscal cliff is looming, and it's funny to hear Republicans who supposedly don't believe in Keynesian economics say, oh, this is terrible, there are going to be defense cuts, and that's going to cost jobs. Suddenly government spending actually creates jobs. You know, honestly, I think if you look at history, Republicans have, certainly the last few decades, Republicans have talked a lot about tax cuts, and they've kept their word on that, and they've talked a lot about spending cuts, and they have never kept their word on that. So I think there's going to be a lot more appetite for additional tax cuts than there is going to be for the kind of tough decisions that would cut spending. And I would think that no matter who wins the election, they're going to kick that fiscal cliff down the road.
And continue to increase the debt/deficit.
Exactly, which, you know, at a time when the economy is this weak and the deficit and the debt, which, you know, are certainly a long-term problem, but all the people who said it would be a short-term problem, that it would create runaway inflation, that you'd see these huge spikes in interest rates, they're not arguably wrong. They're wrong. Inflation has remained low and interest rates have remained historically low. So I think while there's absolutely a need to ultimately get our deficit spending under control, it's not a short-term emergency the way 8% unemployment is.
Looking at some of the money that was spent on poverty or anti-poverty programs, part of the stimulus, food stamps, jobless benefits, a housing program, and yet when you look at the most recent poverty statistics, it's about 15% of the population is poor. And to be poor in this country is to be really, really poor to fit that kind of criteria. Does that, though, raise questions about not just the Obama administration, but also whether the stimulus really did work to help those in greatest need?
Well, I mean, it did prevent another 7 million people from going into poverty, and it made 32 million poor people less poor. Again, it's hard to brag about making things better when things are bad. But people don't understand what happens after these intense financial cataclysms. And it's bad stuff. And depressions, I quote Christy Romer, who's a scholar of the Depression and was Obama's top economic aide for a while. She says, you know, people understand that depressions suck, but if you study depressions, you understand that they really, really suck. Mm-hmm. And as horrible as 8% unemployment is, it's 25% unemployment is a lot worse. And, you know, we are kind of limping along, and nobody's happy with gaining 150,000 jobs a month, but losing 800,000 jobs a month like we did in January is very tough. One example of the way the stimulus helped was there was this new experiment called homelessness prevention that they poured in $1.5 billion to this brand new program. The idea is that to try to catch people before they become homeless, you pay their utility bills or some back rent or their moving expenses so that they can keep a roof over their head and don't bounce into the system where creating terrible social problems and very expensive social problems for the country. It served 1.2 million people that could have otherwise been on the streets. And like in Miami, where I live, the recidivism rate, less than 1% of them have ended up back in the shelter system. And so if half of those 1.2 million people had ended up on the streets, the homeless population would have doubled. And instead, homelessness has actually declined slightly during the worst recession in 80 years. So, again, it's hard to brag about, but things really could have been a lot worse. Just as, you know, it's kind of a counterfactual in the same way, you know, health insurance premiums could have been a lot higher. You know, without financial reform, we might have even worse credit card bills, and, we might be heading into another financial crisis. Even without what Obama did in Libya, you know, who knows what kind of massacres there might have been there. It's very hard to argue the counterfactual, but certainly on the economy and when it comes to poverty, you know, there's pretty direct evidence, and there have been more than a dozen economic studies that have all shown the same thing.
Michael, let me ask you about something else as I look at the clock. We only have a couple of minutes before we have to say goodbye. Today's the 11th anniversary of September 11th. It's a beautiful, cool, crispy day as it was in 2001. And I read your story that you wrote on September 12th. Obviously, we were still trying to figure out what had happened that particular day. I'm just curious about your thoughts today as we think about what happened 11 years ago.
You know, it's tough. I mean, it's such a tragic day. And I do remember I was in the Washington Post newsroom that day, and I did write the lead story. And so some of it, I have these bizarre memories because, you know, I was writing about this national tragedy, but I was also doing the, you know, I was at work. But I, what sort of breaks through for me were you know, some of the mechanical things I was working on. I remember going over this list of missing people that was broken down by company, and there were a couple companies that I had never heard of. One was Aon, and one was Cantor Fitzgerald. And I just remember I was sort of going over clips and reading about them and looking at this list, and I suddenly realized that pretty much the whole company was missing. You know, that an entire, you know, firm that had, you know, grown up and had, you know, fought all of their, you know, all kinds of Wall Street battles, and, you know, one was an insurance company, and certainly, you know, some of them were mundane and some of them were the kind of stuff of ordinary life. But just in a second, practically this whole firm had been murdered. And it really was, I remember in my lead that morning, I used the word astonishing, which I had never used in a lead. And I remember I was sort of trying to debate whether I should use the word astonishing because it's been so debased in our culture, right? Like, you know, oh, that Mets win the other day was astonishing. But I just realized, like, I was astonished. And so I ended up using it. It was sort of a terrible, crazy day.
Indeed it was. Well, Michael Grunewald, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. He's senior national correspondent for Time Magazine and author of this new book called The New Deal, The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about this program. You can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, check out the email, or send us an email, check out the archives, and also check out our new webpage. I'm Marty Moscone. Stay with us for the second hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back. Thank you.